When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
See fingers, not to speak of arms, against the background of moving people and so forth. So if you are proposing to bid, would you please come fairly near the front where I can see you? And hold up your card so that I can see that you are bidding. Some people are fanning themselves with the card and I'm not sure whether they're bidding or not. Lot number 211 is an old album. Would someone bid the reserve of £30? Well, would somebody, I am empowered to go a little less than that. Would somebody say £25? Well, any bid. 15 bid. I need a bit more. I need a minute. Would somebody bid a minimum of £20? I can drop the £20 bid. Any advance from 20? 21? 21? 21 pounds, 22, 22, 22, and 22.
A revolutionary method of proving that the cost of delivering a message from one part of the country to another had been paid was first put into use in 1840. It was an adhesive label which soon became known as the postage stamp. And instead of throwing these stamps away after use, millions of people have kept and collected them, studied them, treasured them, and even over the years grown rich through them. They're the basis of a thriving industry, giving jobs to thousands of people, from their printers to the man who eventually auctions them off at a fancy price many years later. But intrinsically, once used in the post, they have only the value that a collector places on them. And there have been collectors since the earliest days, as Bill Kane tells us.
Well, I was reading one time in a Gibbons magazine, that was a lady in, she was in part of Kent, and she had her wall papered with penny blacks. She had her wall actually papered with penny blacks. You must remember there was millions and millions of those stamps. But people went, and you meet a young boy and he says, oh, I'd love to have a penny black. They think it's a world famous stamp because it was the first adhesive stamp. But there was millions of them. There was no shortage of them. But they were all destroyed and burned. People didn't bother about it. I think the first recognised collection that I remember was somewhere around 1846. I was reading about a gentleman who had collected so many stamps and he was plating them with the letters. Every stamp at that time had letters on it. AA, AB, AC. That's how the sheet was built up. And second row was BA, BB, BC. And he was the first to put them all together to make one page with the full plate, the printing of a stamp. That was in 1846. So they had the philatelic mind at that time even.
This was as soon as it became obvious to people in general that there were different sorts of stamps and that there were different issues and even different stamps among the same issue.
With the one penny black, that he could come along and have philatelic study with it by plating them. That's where it started, plating them.
Remembering back to the time when I was collecting stamps as a schoolboy, one of the great things that you didn't do was buy stamps. The honourable thing was to build up your collection by swapping. But now it seems that most serious collectors have quite a strong orientation towards buying, and buying even at auction where you can be bidding against somebody else, and that there's an element of valuing your hobby by how much it's worth.
Yes, it's a tragedy, that is. For the real collector, you should go back to what you said at the beginning, getting your stamps for nothing. Even today, there's collectors who get full enjoyment from the waste paper basket. They get postmarks, they get all the surcharges, they get all the different countries. They can have so much fun for nothing.
Well, I started, as a lot of collectors do, as a schoolboy.
From Seamus Kearns, a reminiscence that is fairly typical.
And have kept it on with a few, not so much periods where I'd given up collecting as where the collection was a bit dormant. But I always returned to it again in due course when time became a little bit more available or money became a little bit more available, and I've kept it up ever since.
It is a time-consuming hobby, of course.
Oh, it can be, and of course, it's like many hobbies. It uses up exactly whatever amount of time you are prepared to give to it. You can give a comparatively small amount of time, or you can make it 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, if you so desire. Similarly, from the financial end, you can spend a couple of pence a week, or you could spend hundreds of pounds a week, depending on the individual.
Speaking of spending, there does seem to be a recurrent thread, recurrent theme with most of the people we've spoken to, that the value of stamps is not just something that's listed in a book. It's something to marvel at if you've got them in your collection, and grind your teeth at if you haven't.
Yes, well, this is true. I think, like all collecting hobbies, the desire is to have as complete a collection as possible. Some items necessarily are much more rare than others and consequently cost far more if you want to buy them at market value. And, of course, that's where the attraction of the occasional bargain buy comes in. And collectors will really gloat to a tremendous extent over a bargain buy, whereas if they have to go and pay full market price for a thing, there isn't the same thrill attached.
Well, gloat.
Well, gloat. Well, probably the biggest bargain I ever remember getting was on an occasion when I was visiting London at a time when there was an international exhibition on, and I considered that it was probably an occasion when there were more Irish collectors in London than there have ever been at any other point in time. And I passed by a stamp dealer's shop and saw a bundle of covers in the window, which didn't look tremendously exciting, but I was going into the shop in any case, and the proprietor produced these covers to me when I asked him if he had anything interesting in Irish, and I was very delighted to find one major rarity in a cover inside it, and three or four other extremely good covers for a price that was ridiculously out of proportion to the market value of the covers in question.
But you have to know your onions when you're looking for that sort of thing.
You do, of course, because the dealer, it's his business to know stamps, and you are pitting your knowledge against his, and since he is a professional and you are an amateur, the odds are in his favour. But occasionally, particularly in a foreign country, and in this instance London must be taken as a foreign country, this was a dealer whose specialty was in Eastern European stamps. He specialised, in fact, in Greek stamps. His knowledge of Irish stamps was obviously not as good as it might have been.
Ian White, apart from being a dealer himself, is also a collector.
Basically, all stamp collectors are eccentrics. I mean, anybody who collects a useless bit of paper with a bit of gum on the back of it or cancelled it with a nasty-looking black object on the front of it, you know, he's basically an eccentric. Stamp collectors are collecting things that other people would probably throw out in their normal course of life. But bring it on to a stage where you get the serious collector, even the most serious of collectors are eccentric in some ways or others. To give an example, there's this chap I was talking about one time, that the fellow who collects used stamps, genuinely used. Now, most collectors, when they collect a used stamp, they want a used stamp with a nice, neat, circular date stamp. They don't care whether the stamp has ever seen proper duty for which it was issued. But this particular fellow, he wants the stamp genuinely used on an envelope, having served the purpose for which it was issued, i.e. to prepayment of postage.
Of a particular sort.
Of a particular sort, even. To give an example, if he wants a 10-shilling stamp or a 50p stamp used on a parcel, because that's where they're normally used, and most collectors wouldn't want a parcel used copy, because parcels generally have nasty big black postmarks all over them, completely obliterating the stamp, and you can hardly see it. But this fellow wants it. Not only does he want the stamp, but he wants the bit of the parcel so that he can mount that in the thing to show that it was genuinely used on a parcel.
Brown wrapping paper.
Yeah, or he'll want a 15p stamp, which a normal collector wouldn't mind if it was just cancelled by the post office clerk on an envelope that never even went through the post. This chap wants it used on an envelope to Australia or America or for wherever that rate of postage applies. So he's one type of eccentric collector, but the joy in his face, if I produce an envelope dating back 40 years with a 2 and 6 penny stamp, for instance, was one cover I got, which was an envelope to Argentina in about 1934 with a 2 and 6 penny overprint issue of 1922 of Ireland, used genuinely to Argentina, because the rate for airmail in those days was ferocious, and 2 and 6 was a lot of money in those times, and it was very rare that one would use airmail to Argentina. So he's delighted with this, a genuine use of a 2 and 6 penny stamp in 1934. And as I said, he was in a joyous state for about 3 weeks afterwards, you know. But this is another thing. You get a kick as a dealer. You know, you do get a lot of pleasure out of giving a collector something that he likes. You know, even though we're doing a business deal, that you find something, you have a collector who's been searching for years and years for an item, and you can share in his joy in supplying him with that particular thing. You know.
Well, I see collectors as four sort of categories. There's the very wealthy investment collector. I heard a few days ago about the very rare British Guiana 1 cent. I think there is only one of these, but I'm told it's owned by a syndicate of American businessmen. That's got nothing to do with stamp collecting at all. Then there's a second kind, I suppose you could call it speculation. An example of this was the time England played the World Cup in London in 1966, and they issued some stamps about football a few months before. When England won the World Cup, they took the cheapest of those stamps, that was the 4 penny one, and overprinted it England winners, and I believe there were queues all night to buy sheets of this stamp that everybody reckoned was going to bring them a fortune. Of course it did nothing of the sort, because what happened was that everybody had the stamp and eventually they had to unload them, I think probably at a discount to stamp dealers, and certainly I was able to buy a block of them 7 years afterwards at only a few pence over the face value. So you can get your fingers burnt if you do this sort of thing. And the third kind of collector is, I suppose, the general collector, although these must be a dying breed, because it isn't possible to collect stamps generally anymore. There are too many countries issuing too many stamps and they're all getting too dear. So all you can do is you might start off as a youngster, you'll take anything you get and you put them into an album and you've got an album of all the stamps in the world as far as it goes. But if you stay with it, and most kids of course don't, if you stay with it, you do have to specialise. Either you pick a country or maybe a couple of countries, or you pick a period, or you pick a theme. If you stay with a country, you may decide that you'll try and cover it for a particular period. Because, for example, somebody might start tomorrow and say, I'm going to collect British stamps from 1840, the penny blank. Well, he'd have to be a multimillionaire to do it. He'd also have to have an awful lot of time to do it. I don't think it's possible. Or he could say, I'm going to collect British stamps of Edward VII, with every possible shade of colour and every possible variety and any differences of perforations and all this sort of thing. Or you could stick to modern stamps. Of course, most collectors, well, I won't say most collectors, but a lot of collectors, especially senior collectors, tend to sneer at modern stamps because they're not line engraved, they're surface printed. And they're often called rubbish. In fact, some of them are very expensive rubbish, and some of them, oddly enough, have a curious habit of getting very valuable, like the Australian ones that have gone up by leaps and bounds since decimalisation.
Tony Quigley there with a philosophical view of his fellow collectors. Many young people stop collecting just before it really gets interesting. David Glass didn't.
I found an old stamp catalogue somewhere or other, and I started arranging my stamps systematically, and I think that's the beginning of a real stamp collector, once he starts to arrange things and to have some idea of chronology.
When you're at sea, it's very nice to have a hobby, and stamps are something that you can take with you because they're very light. And also, when you're visiting foreign places, it's easy to buy stamps in those countries. And sometimes you can visit stamp dealers too and pick up things that might be cheaper there or easier to get there than they are in Ireland. And it was especially interesting when I went to ports in Britain and Canada, the USA, because these are all great stamp collecting countries, and there are lots of stamp shops. But other countries, for example, in Africa and South America and so forth, it's not so well developed as it is in Europe.
It was an accident how I started collecting. My mother was in the intensive care in the Mater Hospital, and she was to have some operation, and I was very upset about it. And we're passing the RDS, and we saw Stamper up. So I said, I'd like to go in there. And I went in with my husband, and he met somebody he knew there who was a member of the Dublin Stamp Society. So I was invited to go to the meeting. I think it was the following week. And that's how my career in stamp collecting started.
Was your husband a collector?
No.
Ever?
Never. And neither was I. I had a few old albums that were given to me as a child with stamps stuck in, with glue and things like that. But he was not a collector.
One of the things that we've been told by men who collect stamps is that very often they started collecting because other chaps in the class were collecting when they were 8, 9, 10, 11. Was there anything like that at your school?
Yes, I used to collect them for other people. They were collectors. I would collect stamps for them. Well, it was possibly because I was at school in England, but my stamps were possibly more useful to them. But I had no real inclination to collect stamps myself. And I thought I needed a relaxing hobby, and when I went to the meeting, I decided this was going to be my little hobby. And it has been.
For how long?
For a year now, last November.
Alice Fogarty, a recent convert. Bill Kane remembers the indiscriminate collecting he began with in the 20s.
In that time you had the printed albums, and they had spaces in them. That had been carried down from about 1870 or 1880, when they started to print these albums with the whole world in them. And the boy's ambition was to fill his album, one stamp of every country.
And then complete every page?
Every page. That's the idea, to fill the book completely.
How do you get interested in the slightly more complicated varieties of collecting, like making sure you had complete sets of things?
Yes, well, you must remember that in that time, the philatelic magazines gave you headlines, from a halfpenny to a shilling. The British Commonwealth, that was the popular buy of those days. The tragedy is, the people with knowledge in that period of time, they went and bought the half crown, 5 shillings, 10 shillings, and 10 shilling stamps of British Commonwealth, which now run into hundreds of pounds. The halfpenny to the shilling stamps are so common that they haven't the rateable value in comparison to the other 4 stamps. The tragedy is, the publicity of them times led everyone to buy halfpenny to a shilling, and the scarce ones were the top values that nobody ever bought, which are valuable today.
I've been collecting for 30 years now.
And what's your age?
Well, I'm 35. I started when I was 5. My father started me off when I got the mumps, and to keep me occupied in bed, he started bringing home stuff from the waste bins in the office. And I've been collecting ever since, but I've gone beyond the stamps a little bit now. That I've most of it, I've nearly all the Irish stamps, and I collect mainly Ireland and Holland. I've gone into the postal history aspect of it, the pre-stamp and the British stamps were used in Ireland. And one thing that I think should be pointed out is that people, when they're clearing out attics, and that they shouldn't destroy all the old letters and things that they have in the attic, that a lot of these can be quite valuable, not from a monetary point of view, but from the information point of view, that all the records of Irish postal history were destroyed in the fires of the 1916-1922 period, and we're piecing up the history of these pre that time purely by what collectors have, what they've seen, what they know to exist. And every day somebody's finding something that puts the date a bit further forward or backward of something. A lot of these turn up by accident. People die, their stuff is cleared out into a bonfire anywhere. My wife rescued a collection of postcards from a bonfire for me. And when I brought it home, I found that in it there was a postcard that had the earliest known machine postmark of Dublin in it, and is, as far as I know, the earliest known now, which puts a week earlier the date of the arrival of the first machine in Dublin. People, I mean, when they are clearing stuff out, I wish that they, of course, they don't know who to get in contact with. I think philatelists are working in the dark a lot. People don't know that there are the societies, and they don't know who to contact. The post office can usually help them, the head office, and put them on to somebody. It's just that if they, rather than burn something or throw it out, that it could be quite interesting. That a lot of the stuff, 19th century stuff, is, they might think it's common that everybody has it, but the dates of usage, or there might be some rare postmark. The stamp itself might be worth nothing, but the postmark on the envelope, don't tear the stamp off the envelope, but that the envelope might be worth much more than the stamp, which is usually the case in the early stuff. It's the actual usage of the stamp, the route it travelled, the postmarks, the town it was posted in, all that sort of thing is, it's still not known what the setup in the post office was in the last century. Dublin's had a post office since the end of the 17th century, but there are very few of the examples of the 17th century or very early 18th century around. But we're still trying to piece together what the setup was at the time, and every little helps.
John Lennon's cri de coeur of the collector turned postal historian. He and others like him often rely on their friends and contacts in philatelic societies for these chance discoveries. But they benefit everyone, the societies, according to Brian Dyson.
I think that people can benefit, if they're interested in stamps at all, they can benefit from being a member of a society. My own experience is, I think, a case in point, because I don't have a great deal of time or a great deal of money to spend on stamps. And I've been a member of a society for the past 5 or 6 years, and I found that although my own collection hasn't really expanded greatly in that time, my philatelic knowledge has increased simply by meeting other collectors and seeing their collections at our regular meetings. I've also found that philatelists are the most friendly people. There's no feeling of being out of things because one's own collection may be modest and one's own knowledge fairly restricted. They're all very friendly, and I find it a great benefit.
So you'd recommend it?
I would indeed, yes. Yes, I think no matter how near the beginning in collecting a person is, it is useful to join together with other philatelists.
Like many other collectors, Tony Byrne started young and later lapsed.
In later years, I just took up the hobby again, joined the society, and well, here I am.
You take things very seriously in the stamp collecting business, do you?
I wouldn't say very seriously. Just like to get some items. May not be able to afford them, so you've got to try and build up, search around for bargains and things like that, going from one dealer to the other.
Do you specialise?
Yeah, I specialise in Irish airmails for slide covers and that. These are covers that's carried on special flights or inaugural flights for the airlines.
Is it a very limited thing, specialising in something like that? There can't be all that many of them, surely.
There's quite a lot of them, but it is very limiting, but you can trace the history, we say, of Irish aviation, the history through from the first flights, the early ones, like around about 1928, up to date.
And do you do that? I mean,
I do that. There are quite a few publications available that you can get, and they give you the background information. From that, then you search through all newspapers for information. You look for covers, possibly with the pilot's signature on it, so that from one particular flight, you may be able to collect about 10 covers, all relating to that flight, stages of the journey, and it gives you a background history of it. And this itself can be very interesting and rewarding.
Barry Trelfell also started young, but with a slight advantage.
Well, my father started, and he passed the collection down to my brother. And the two of us collected stamps.
Together?
Together, yes. Like many children, of course, I pasted them in instead of using stamp hinges at that time. But then he lost interest in them, and I kept on, you see, took his over his collection and carried on.
Did that give you a collection in rather better condition than your own?
Well, slightly, yes. But it wasn't until, you see, I'm English, actually, and when I came here to Ireland, I started to take it up more seriously then and to specialise.
In that case, then, you would probably have been one of the kids in school that other boys were impressed by and started collecting from.
I never lost interest, though, really.
At all?
No. No, even when I came here, I... Well, of course, in those days, pocket money wasn't very much, so obviously I couldn't buy many stamps, but I never lost interest and kept it up.
Do you specialise now?
I do, yes. I collect a certain group of countries, Switzerland, Australia, Ireland, Great Britain, and one or two others.
And why those?
Well, specifically, really, more or less to get a fairly good collection together than just trying to collect the whole world. Because it'd be impossible to, unless you were just collecting the odd used stamp here and there, you see, it'd be impossible to collect the whole world. Particularly if you're going for mint stamps.
And that's what you are going for, is it?
That's what I collect mostly.
Totally.
I do collect used as well, in relation to Ireland and Great Britain.
But why those particular countries, though? I mean, you mentioned Switzerland and Australia.
Well, the Swiss stamps are really beautiful stamps, to my mind. I like the design of them. They're attractive. The printing is good. They don't issue too many. And they appreciate in value.
And there we come back to value again.
There you come back to value again.
Do you anticipate ever selling your collection?
No, not really, no. I don't think so.
Well, then why does it seem to be of so much interest to collectors?
Well,
how valuable it is?
Well, of course, it's like most things these days. I mean, take coins, antiques. I mean, you go in for valuation. Stamps, of course, can be an investment as well. And you can buy, say, for instance, the classical stamps, the penny black, the twopenny blue, several other classical issues of other countries. Even if you are not a collector, you could still make a small profit on them if you kept them.
Long enough.
I mean, take a typical example now of the Pound Postal Union Congress, which I know a friend of mine bought in 1958 for £8. It's now selling at about 750 to £800, which is quite an appreciation.
But a true collector won't be interested in selling.
No, a true collector wouldn't be interested in selling. It's his hobby.
A little-known fact is that the state is also a stamp collector, and the core of that collection was assembled by a noted nobleman of the last century, as Fred Dixon tells us.
The Duke of Leinster was collecting, well, just about 100 years ago, was the time when he was most active, and he was one of the world's leading collectors at a time when only people like himself could afford to indulge to any great extent. And he did build up a very notable collection, though he would not be regarded as an advanced philatelist in the modern sense. He was mainly concerned with getting one example of each stamp from any part of the world. Well, one used and one unused, which went into separate albums. When he died, this collection was bequeathed to the Irish nation to be housed in the National Museum. And Dr. Lane Joint, who was largely responsible for organising it for display, sent a letter to most of the philatelic magazines and asking for assistance in filling some of the gaps. And the museum wrote to the postal authorities in other countries, and they nearly all rose to the occasion. And there were many notable additions to the Duke of Leinster's initial collection, that some of the outstanding rarities came in this way. Although, naturally, many of the good things were there from the Duke's own collection. Incidentally, it was the 1890s that, I forget the exact date, that he died. And within a very short time, by 1900, the collection was on display in the museum in beautifully made cabinets with sliding panels, double-sided glass, so that you could mount sheets on both sides. I mentioned the great rarities that came in. Well, probably the rarest item is a block of four of a sixpence Edward VII English stamp, overprinted IR official. It was a remarkable circumstance that only a few days after these had been distributed, it was decided not to continue the use of such things, and they were withdrawn. And this block of four, which was presented to the National Museum for the Leinster Collection, is the only incomplete block of four known to exist outside the official archives in London. Only single copies have escaped otherwise. And it's a very, very special treasure. Though it's not as well known as it's really regarded as the highlight of the Duke's collection, is the famous Western Australian stamp with the swan design at the centre, inverted. This was on show at the Stamper exhibition last year. And it's a stamp with a particularly fascinating story, because it was first discovered by a man named Pegg, living in London. And he wrote to the then leading expert, Dr. Gray, in the British Museum, who replied that he was very interested in seeing it, but he couldn't understand it. Well, that letter still survived with the stamp, and I hope it's still in the National Museum, because it gives a pedigree to the particular item. Well, we don't know exactly how Mr. Pegg parted with it, but the next known owner was Mr. Morris, a teacher in high school, Dublin. And a young man named Vance had seen it in Mr. Morris's collection, and he told the Duke of Leinster about it, and the Duke authorised him to go up to £3 to buy it. Mr. Vance, being fairly smart, managed to get it for £2, and the Duke gave him a few of his duplicate stamps as well as the £3. But another fascinating aspect of the story is that although he had paid so much for it, and it was really special, the Duke, at the time of his death, had agreed to exchange it for £70 worth of another man's stamps, another collector. And when the Dr. Lane Joint was taking over the albums for the museum, this Western Australian stamp could not be found. It wasn't in either of the two albums. But it did turn up in a pile of papers with the correspondence with the other collector. And so it was put back in its place. It's marvellous what stories there can be about such stamps.
And about such collectors.
Yes. Though we don't know very much about... This is the sixth Duke of Leinster, and I don't know anything else about him except that he was a very notable stamp collector. And he hobnobbed that the... Now, where he had a talk with this young man, Vance, was in a stationer's shop, I think, in Grafton Street, where there was one part of the counter was devoted to stamps. And then, as now, there was very pleasant camaraderie in the stamp shop, that everybody chatted, and it was quite a meeting place. Whether it was lunchtime, I don't know. It was just, but it, apparently everybody gathered.
And it didn't matter who you were.
Didn't matter who you were. The Duke rubbed shoulders with schoolboys. Though I say schoolboys couldn't afford to buy many stamps in those days.
So it was quite a windfall for young Mr. Vance.
Yes. I don't know what happened to him. His name is in history only just the once.
Other collectors, like Dermot O'Kelly, are trying to create at least a family tradition of collecting.
I have tried to get my children interested in stamp collecting while they were quite young by starting them off on a country each. The case of two of them, this fell through, but I have four sons. These four sons, the eldest one got interested. I started him off on a collection. I helped him build up a collection of a country as well as Ireland. He became interested in that and built it up himself considerably, and then his interest changed, that he changed his interest to a new country and eventually was able to build that up quite successfully by selling the previous country, which he lost interest in, the original one. Second son has no interest at all in it, and the third son has no interest, but the fourth son has. My eldest son has actually taken it up as his profession.
One of the ways of encouraging young collectors in their enthusiasm, as Tony Finn points out, is the National Stamp Exhibition, Stampa.
I was the assistant secretary of the stamp exhibition there last year. The National Stamp Exhibition is held every year, each November, and it has been held since 1972. The object of the exhibition is to promote interest in philately in Ireland. With that in mind, we provide a display of stamps. We have a number of dealers who are involved each year. Last year, actually, we had a very good attendance of dealers, nearly 20, some of whom had come from England and the United States. And the Irish Post Office also are involved, and they give us very generous support each year.
Is it the sort of exhibition that really attracts, let's say, young people?
Yes, very much so. Actually, the number of young collectors we get at the exhibition each year is quite outstanding. A lot of schools around the country now have their own stamp societies or stamp clubs, and the stamp exhibition has, as it were, become a day out for them. And this year, out of an attendance of about 4,000 people at the exhibition, almost 1,000 of those were young stamp collectors.
And on a senior level, the few philatelic societies in Ireland are trying to foster organisational growth. David Rose.
Our main object in the Federation is to form other societies in other towns, to help them to get the idea of society by inviting them up to our meetings and going down to their meetings. But in the world of international philately, I mean, in England, one county would have 100 societies. And every country in the world has a federation, and they're affiliated to the FIP, the Fédération Internationale de Philatélie, which is now 50 years old. And one day we hope that Ireland will be able to to affiliate to that federation as well. But our main object is philately in Ireland and not abroad, but Ireland must have an outward-looking approach to philately as well.
Not only on the part of the sales of stamps for the post office, but also on the part of collectors.
Collectors and exhibiting internationally. You see, there have been Irish winners of gold and silver medals abroad, but not so much in the last few years.
A further development on the official side would be a national postal museum, as Fred Dixon advocates.
There's no doubt there's widespread feeling in philatelic circles that there should be a national postal museum.
What would be the value of a national postal museum?
Well, it would be, one thing, a tourist attraction. That throughout the world, stamp collecting, philately, are still growing hobbies of tremendous interest and, of course, considerable educational value, although that's a point that I don't think needs to be stressed too much. But Ireland, unfortunately, has rather a wet climate. And when tourists come here, they definitely need something to do on wet afternoons and wet mornings. And museums should be far more numerous and diversified than they are at present. And as is evidenced in various countries, there's tremendous interest in something specialised, like a postal museum or a ceramics museum or a glass museum. Each subject can be treated separately. And the postal museum, well, it could be a little wider than that. For example, stamps include not only postage stamps, but revenue stamps. And the early Irish revenue stamps were magnificently engraved, dies for embossing into the parchments. And we have a wealth of fascinating material in that field. And for postal material, certainly you can go right back to the 17th century. A huge range.
This would be before the stamp, the sort of...
Before the adhesive stamp, yes. And a well-mounted and explained display of such material is a value not only of interest to collectors, but to students of economic history, social history.
One can clearly get into very deep water indeed, simply by starting to collect those little sticky bits of paper, which, as Ian White said, most people would throw away. Fundamentally, though, it's a hobby, a pastime, an enjoyment. And this is what continues to attract even the most serious collectors.
Personally, I think a hobby should be for personal enjoyment. If at the end of the line, when you decide you finish with your hobby and you can relinquish it and make a profit on it, that's the happy circumstance. But to collect for the sole purpose of making X pounds at the end of a period of time, that's not good. That's not a real philatelist's outlook at all. He gets the personal enjoyment from his outlay, and if at the end of the time he sells it with a small profit, he's a happy man.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.